Republican Steve King has served Iowa in Congress since 2003. Will the predicted midterm blue wave impact King and Iowa's 4th District? It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, political scientists Valerie Hennings of Morningside College in Sioux City and Dave Anderson of Iowa State University look at King and his Democratic challenger, J.D. Scholten. Before that, Dennis Goldford, Drake University, gives us his thoughts on the partisan battle lines in the Kavanaugh confirmation. Also, other political news. Of course, there's plenty out there. Join our conversation. First, this news from NPR. It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, we'll focus on the 4th Congressional District here in Iowa, in western Iowa. From here on out, we have just, 5 weeks before the midterm election, 33 days, and we're going to be focusing each politics day on one of the congressional districts from this point on. Today, the 4th is on, and we'll have two political scientists from the 4th District. Dave Anderson, we know well from Iowa State University. Also, Valerie Hennings will be joining us from Morningside College in Sioux City a bit later in the program. For our first half of our program, so glad to have Dennis Goldford with us, professor and chair of political science at Drake University, joining us, I believe, from his office at Drake University in Des Moines. Dennis, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Ben. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're at 6 days after an extraordinary Senate hearing last week, watched by millions of people. University professor Christine Blasey Ford detailed her sexual assault allegation against the Supreme Court nominee, Judge Brett Kavanaugh. The FBI's investigation soon to wrap up, as soon as today, I think, some reports into the sexual misconduct allegations against Brett Kavanaugh, with a vote on the Supreme Court nomination possibly by the end of the week. Let's listen to the Senator Mitch McConnell, majority leader, on the Senate floor yesterday, criticizing Democrats for calling for an FBI investigation, saying that they keep moving the goalpost.
So soon, I expect we'll hear that the conclusions of the expert prosecutor who questioned both witnesses at last week's hearing aren't reliable, or that the FBI's investigation was not infinite or endless enough for their liking. Maybe we'll hear the real issue is not these uncorroborated allegations of misconduct after all, but rather the fact that Judge Kavanaugh, now listen to this, drank beer in high school and in college, or the fact that he was rightfully angry. Who wouldn't be? That his good name and his family have been dragged through the mud with a campaign of character assassination based on allegations that lack any corroboration. Who wouldn't be angry about that, Mr. President? Their goalposts keep shifting, but their goal hadn't moved an inch, not an inch. The goal's been the same all along. And so let me make it very clear. The time for endless delay and obstruction has come to a close. Judge Kavanaugh's nomination is out of committee. We're considering it here on the floor. And Mr. President, we'll be voting this week.
Mitch McConnell, majority leader in the Senate yesterday. And join our conversation here with Dennis Goldford in the first half hour, 1-866-780-9100. Your questions about the FBI investigation and this controversial Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. So comment on the GOP's tact there, encapsulated by the narrative there, encapsulated by Majority Leader Connell, Dennis.
Well, the first thing I would say, perhaps on a more personal note, is I wish I were a chemistry professor or an art history professor instead of a political science professor. This is as ugly and awful as I have ever seen American politics. It's simply terrible. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, there are three different kinds of issues at stake here in the Kavanaugh nomination. The first is the question, and it's the one to which the Republicans want to keep this whole thing restricted, as to whether there is credible evidence that Mr. Kavanaugh did commit some sort of act of sexual assault or aggression when he was in high school on this particular complainant, Dr. Ford. That's the first question. And, of course, Speaker McConnell said there's no corroborating evidence. But when you set up a hearing without other witnesses or a prior investigation, you set it up so it's he said, she said, without any other way of finding out if there's corroborating evidence. So if there is none, one way or the other, in his favor or against him, the hearing was set up to make sure there would be no corroborating evidence. But whatever the situation with that, the hearing raised two other kinds of questions, which I think are the more dominant questions at this point, with no disrespect to the seriousness of any possible sexual assault. The first is whether Judge Kavanaugh has been honest in his testimony and sworn testimony about his high school activities and other such things, about whether he had a drinking issue, things like that. Has he been honest in what he's been saying? Some people say yes, many people say no. And perhaps more fundamentally, given that he's applying to be a judge or justice of the Supreme Court, it's what we saw at the hearing last Thursday. Does he have the right temperament to be a sitting judge, let alone a justice, on the Supreme Court? It's one thing to be deeply wounded, offended by charges you believe are without basis. You can say simply, as they did for a while, yes, I believe something happened to Dr. Ford at that time, but I'm not the person that did it. You've got the wrong guy. You can say that. But at the hearing, that morphed immediately into an unhinged, partisan, slashing attack on Democrats, liberal groups, everybody else, ending up with what goes around comes around. And if the shoe were on the other foot and you had a Democratic-nominated judge in this position, absolutely Republicans would be arguing that this person would not have the temperament to be a sitting federal judge or justice on the Supreme Court.
Dennis, you raised a number of points there. I'm glad you sort of outlined that, the basic outlines of what's being discussed right now. Also mentioned in this clip, our Senator Joni Ernst, in conversation with CBS News this morning, this was yesterday, she mentioned one of those. I mean, and this is a good demonstration of sort of the line that the Republicans are walking here in not denying that Christine Blasey Ford was traumatized by some experience. Let's let the senator speak for herself. Senator Ernst says she's supporting Brett Kavanaugh unless the FBI investigation contains information that would corroborate Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's testimony.
What message that sends to women in America is that we are innocent until proven guilty in this great country. And I have absolutely no doubt after reviewing Dr. Ford's testimony that she has suffered from something very traumatic in her lifetime. But simply the corroboration wasn't there with even the witnesses that she brought forward.
What about this point, Dennis, that anyone deserves to be presumed innocent until proven guilty?
Certainly in a criminal trial, but that's not what this is. In a criminal trial, yes, the presumption is you are innocent until and unless the government can present a good and compelling case that you are guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. No question about that. This, however, is not a criminal trial. It's a job application, essentially, and it's a job interview. And surely no employer believes when he or she is interviewing a prospective job candidate that that job candidate is presumed to get the job unless the potential employer gives a good and compelling reason why the job candidate shouldn't. The presumption lies with the job candidate to make the good and compelling case for why he or she should have that job. So I believe Senator Ernst, as others, have their presumptions mixed up.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a little bit of the president last night at a rally in Mississippi. This is what's hitting the news this morning, has been much talked about, also criticized even by some Republican leaders. A key vote there, Jeff Flake, the senator from Arizona, calling what you're about to hear appalling. Susan Collins of Maine, a Republican, calling this just plain wrong. Let's listen to what they're talking about. Last night at a rally in Mississippi, President Ford mocking Christine Blasey Ford.
what he's going through. 36 years ago, this happened. I had one beer, right? I had one beer. Well, do you think it was? Nope, it was one beer. Oh, good. How did you get home? I don't remember. How'd you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. What neighborhood was it in? I don't know. Where's the house? I don't know. Upstairs, downstairs, where was it? I don't know. But I had one beer. That's the only thing I remember. And a man's life is in tatters. A man's life is shattered. His wife is shattered. His daughters, who are beautiful, incredible young kids.
Okay, the president making fun of Christine Blasey Ford, receiving criticism for it today as well, but also sympathizing with Brett Kavanaugh, Dennis.
Well, what happened to the president's claim last week, Thursday or Friday, after the hearing, at which he said she was very impressive, she was a very credible witness, and now he's flipped to the other side? In other words, what are we supposed to take seriously in what the president says?
What do you make of that of that about face, that change from she's very credible to mocking her?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, by some accounts, his staff have been trying to keep him quiet and under control and keep him from launching into a kind of raging rant like that. But he can't apparently stop himself. I mean, some have claimed that that reflects his resentment over the kinds of accusations, fair or not, accurate or not, that he's had to put up with over the course of his public life and certainly his political career over the last 2 years. So in that sense, he's talking not in terms of, according to these accounts, not really talking in terms of Judge Kavanaugh directly, that may be nominally the case. He's really talking about his own sense of self embroiled in controversies like this.
Dennis Goldford with us of Drake University, our political scientist from Drake, picking apart, of course, the Kavanaugh controversy. Later in the hour, we're going to focus on politics in Iowa's 4th Congressional District. Let's go back to a point being talked about. You mentioned earlier, too, the demeanor question, criticisms of Brett Kavanaugh's demeanor at times during the testimony. Not exactly what one would wish from a judge, let alone a justice of the Supreme Court. And this also is bothering one of the key votes here, the Republican Arizona Senator Jeff Flake. He commented that the testimony Kavanaugh gave on Friday worries him.
I was very troubled by the tone of the remarks. The initial defense that that Judge Kavanaugh gave was something like I told my wife. I hope that I would sound that indignant if I were if I felt that I was unjustly, you know, maligned. But then it went on, and the interaction with the members was sharp and partisan, and that concerns me.
Sharp and partisan. Dennis, what interactions along these lines stuck out for you?
Well, as I said earlier, I mean, the mask seemed to come off. It was just compelling television, gripping. I was able to watch that, and then after Thursday, I couldn't watch anymore of the repeats of the clips afterwards because they were so upsetting. This was sort of a raw, wounded partisanship and revenge fantasy on the part of Judge Kavanaugh. Again, what goes around comes around. And again, as I said, if you believe yourself unjustly and unfairly and inaccurately accused of something you truly believe you didn't do, there are ways of dealing with that, not by saying this is some partisan cabal against me and I'm going to get even at some point. You want a judge of at any level, of any court, just the way a professor in dealing with students, you have to be as fair and open-minded and as objective as possible. What Judge Kavanaugh revealed at that particular instance, even though he had echoed in his first hearings Chief Justice Roberts' claims that judges and justices are supposed to be empires. We don't move the strike zone. We simply call balls and strikes.
But we have had justices. Ruth Bader Ginsburg comes to mind, not to this degree, I don't think, but making partisan comments. I think,
and she walked that back instantly, saying, "I was wrong. I was mistaken. I should not have done that." And she didn't do that with the visceral anger and rage and tears that we saw from Judge Kavanaugh. Again, I understand being upset if you believe you've been unfairly charged, but given the job you're applying for, you've got to bear in mind what you have to do to demonstrate that you're capable of rising above that visceral emotion.
Mm-hmm.
In that response, there are no umpires. They're simply Cubs and Cardinals.
Mm-hmm. Of these three facets that we're looking at that you mentioned here, the sexual misconduct allegations, the sort of mischaracterization of himself, his background, and his demeanor, which area, from the vantage point we have today, Wednesday, the 3rd of October, do you see as most serious, seriously endangering this confirmation?
Well, depending upon what the FBI investigation reveals about the incident alleged to have happened, in 1982, that's sort of up in the air, and we don't know where that is at this particular point. What we do have evidence of right now are questions, if not answers, but questions about honesty and temperament. And I think that in terms of the remaining holdouts from either party, Manchin, say, on the Democratic side, Heidi Heitkamp possibly, and Flake and Collins and Murkowski, I think at the moment, depending upon what the FBI comes up with, the honesty and particularly the temperament issues seem to be at the moment the core issues.
Mm-hmm. We have most often mentioned the senators Flake, Murkowski, and Collins, but you have two Democratic senators. Give us the angle on that. Help us understand the position they are in judging this.
Well, they're running for re-election for a Senate seat in states that went extremely in favor of, strongly in favor of President Trump. Now, you could argue that if you vote against Kavanaugh, that will anger the Republicans in those states and they'll turn out at even higher levels. On the other hand, you could argue they're already coming out because they're such Trump supporters. So do you really gain yourself something by voting for Kavanaugh? Do you get any kind of appreciable net gain among Republicans who wouldn't have voted for you if you voted against Kavanaugh compared to what you might lose among Democrats? If they're angry with you for supporting Judge Kavanaugh. So they're certainly in a difficult position,
mm-hmm.
and they have to weigh that.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to put on my rose-colored glasses and ask a naive question. Why isn't this just about whether it happened or not?
Well, there's so many. That's what I said at the beginning, why I wish I were a chemistry professor. It's just so ugly right now across all sorts of dimensions by people who are uncomfortable with the pace of modern social change, economic change, and cultural change. And so this has sort of crystallized a whole bunch of these conflicts that have just riven our country, amplified, exacerbated by cable TV, social media, and talk radio.
Mm-hmm. Let's assume that all the Democrats in the Senate en bloc vote together against this nominee. We have Jeff Flake, Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins there as the potential no votes in the GOP column. So Senate Republicans hold a narrow 51-49 advantage. Explain the math to us when it comes down to the vote, which could come as soon as, I guess, Friday or even Saturday, right?
If the Democrats hold together, and that's a big if the Republicans can lose one vote because Vice President Pence can break a 50-50 tie, if the Republicans lose two votes and the Democrats hold together, then it's at least 51-49 against confirmation.
Then the Vice President does no good, and he doesn't even enter the picture.
Right, only in the case of a tie. I think for the Republicans, you have to say, look, like it or not, justifiably or not, depending upon your position, Kavanaugh is damaged goods. The president has every authority and right and responsibility in the world to nominate someone to the Supreme Court of his choosing based upon his criteria, which happens to be the originalist jurisprudence of the Federalist Society. They can do better than Kavanaugh. They can do better finding someone who isn't damaged goods. Now, the president and Republicans may want to ram him through anyway out of sheer anger and irritation, but they'd be putting damaged goods on the court.
Right, but could they get a conservative in the line of Kavanaugh, In time before.
In time for before, what?
Before the before the lame duck session.
Well, they've got you know, the new Congress doesn't take effect until what, January 3rd, I think it is, of roughly January 3rd of next year. And so, you know, Mitch McConnell will schedule meetings of the Senate whenever he wants. He'll let them go whenever he wants. He controls the Senate calendar. So he can say the Senate will be in session and we will do this. Mm-hmm. And recall they left that position. Oh, they left a position, not this one, but the Scalia position vacant for almost a year for their particular political purposes. So there is no clock running in any official or required sense. It's simply the political calculations of the majority in the Senate, which could well be a Democratic majority. I mean, it's simply that it's whoever the majority is controls the calendar of the Senate.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, before we say goodbye here in a couple of minutes, I wanted to get your impressions of the New York Times report yesterday that Donald Trump engaged in tax schemes, including cases of fraud in which he and his siblings helped they helped their parents dodge millions of dollars in taxes. White House calling the Times investigation misleading, inaccurate, but the Times relying on what they call a vast trove of confidential tax returns, financial records. They've analyzed this for over a year. They say that contrary to Trump's claims during the campaign, his fortune came because he helped his parents evade taxes, setting up a fake corporation with his siblings, disguising millions of dollars in gifts from their parents. Comment on that. We have a minute or two left there. The implications as well. Can you, as a sitting president, be indicted for tax fraud?
Well, remember, I'm not a lawyer and certainly not a tax lawyer. But from what I've read, statutes of limitations are done on these things, but there can be civil penalties. But, you know, part of this is the myth, or at least the claim, the president staked his claim to his qualifications for office by saying, I'm a self-made man. Now, there was substantial evidence that he wasn't. You know, he didn't start off with a couple of sticks and rub them together and created this whole business. You know, if you got a small loan from your father, well, $1 million then certainly wasn't a small loan. It's not even a small loan now.
Yeah, but we're looking at much more than $1 million now.
Right. But the question is, will anybody be listening? In other words, you know, normally you want to say, I believe in X because it's true. But where have we moved into an era when I say, I consider X true because I believe it, or I consider X false because I don't believe it?
The subjective trumps the objective and the scientific.
That's the issue. In other words, who's going to read and listen to this? With an open mind at this point. Mm-hmm. That's the concerning factor.
Very quickly before we say goodbye, 33 days out, a blue wave, yes or no? How big, if so, Senate, House?
This is a heck of a long time until the election. I know some early voting has started. I'd still be surprised if the Democrats took back the Senate. The odds were always against them. I think they have a good chance of taking the House. But we're 32, 33, 34 days out, and that's a long time if you're counting on current situation carrying through.
And the speed of developments in so many of these stories. Dennis Goldford, thank you very much for joining us this half hour, professor and chair of political science at Drake University. Dennis, until next time.
Sure. See you then, Ben.
All right. When we come back, we'll concentrate on the 4th Congressional District here in Iowa. We're 5 weeks away from the midterms. We'll have two political scientists who are based in the 4th District, Valerie Hennings of Morningside College in Sioux City and Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. Join us, especially if you live in the 4th District. It's Politics Wednesday. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. You want to tune in tomorrow. My guest, political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben. She works at NPR's Washington desk. Talking with her tomorrow about gender politics, demographics, economic policy in this midterm election campaign. Also, tomorrow on the program, we'll hear Clay Masters' extended interview with Democratic gubernatorial candidate Fred Hubbell. Yes, of course, it's intensifying. 5 weeks until our midterm elections. If you don't like politics, perhaps you need to find that hermit hut you have in the woods for such cases. Let's concentrate on the 4th Congressional District with our guests this hour. Valerie Hennings is Associate Professor of Political Science, Director for the Colonel Bud Day Center for Civic Engagement at Morningside College in Sioux City. Valerie Hennings, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Dave Anderson is with us, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Ben. How are you today?
Very well. We picked both of you for your expertise, of course, but also because you're both located in Iowa's 4th District. We have the northwest part of the state in the 4th District, Sioux City, Ames, Mason City, Fort Dodge, Boone, Carroll. The Democrat, J.D. Shulton, is challenging the incumbent, eight-term Republican Steve King, also Libertarian Charles Aldrich, Independent Edward Peterson. King serving Iowa. Now, we did some redistricting, so we can't say it's always in the 4th District. He's served eight terms. He's been serving since 2003. Dave, let me have you take the first crack at this. Describe in broad outlines politically Iowa's 4th.
Well, the Iowa 4th is a rather rural, very conservative district. It's the most conservative district in Iowa. And it is as reliably Republican as most districts get. I think it's about the 119th most Republican district in the country. It's a safe zone for Republican candidates. And Steve King has represented the district pretty well for quite some time now.
Mm-hmm. Valerie Hennings, tell us a little bit about the challenger this time to Steve King in the Democratic column.
Well, I think something to consider when we are thinking about J.D. Shulton as a challenger is that he does provide this alternative candidate, this outsider that many voters often look for when we are thinking about an incumbent who, in the case of Steve King, he has been serving for the past eight terms. So when we think about J.D., we know that he is 38 years old, and he has connections to both my hometown of Sioux City, and he's got connections to Ames as well, and a lot of agricultural roots when we think about his family in terms of farming. He went to school here at Morningside College, right alongside me as well, and he provides this opportunity of someone who is very relatable. He's an athlete, and that that element of who he is and that professional background he has woven into his campaign as he's made his way around the 4th District into all 39 counties. So I think in many ways that's one thing to think about when it comes to J.D. He provides an alternative.
Mm-hmm. An alternative, it sounds like you're saying also that he could energize younger voters?
I would agree. And I think in many ways we have seen that through the way that he has conducted his campaign. In some ways he has done kind of what we would expect when it comes to the typical campaign handbook, what we know works, getting out there face-to-face. But he has done a fantastic job of bringing in younger voters to incorporate in those different rallies through communities throughout the 4th District. So I think in many ways for voters, and we do know that younger voters are looking for a different option, something different, and he provides that in many different ways.
Mm-hmm. Now, J.D. Shulton, trying to challenge this incumbent, which for anybody is difficult, for any challenger. Earlier this month, Shulton challenged 4th District Congressman Steve King to a debate or a free throw contest.
This message is for Congressman Steve King. I, J.D. Shulton, am challenging you to a series of three debates. One, you haven't had a debate or a town hall here in several years. People deserve to hear what you have to say. Two, farm prices have collapsed to below the 2002 level, the year you were elected and first into office. Why aren't you on the Farm Bill Conference Committee fighting for the people of this district? And three, on taxpayer dime, five out of the last 6 years you've gone to Austria to meet with far-right and neo-Nazi groups. How is that benefiting Iowa and Iowa's 4th Congressional District? So that's why I'm challenging you to these debates. As an alternative, we could also do a free throw contest. The ball's in your court.
Ball's in your court. You have to get the visual there, of course, on a basketball court. Steve King responding by saying he didn't see the need for a debate.
If there's not a clear division on issues here, then, you know, if nobody's criticizing the way I vote, they just call names. And I don't think that that's a very good reason to have a debate.
Mm-hmm. Dave Anderson, so when an incumbent is this comfortable in a, in this case, solidly Republican district? I mean, a candidate of either party really doesn't have to mess around with the debates, right?
No. A lot of time incumbents try to avoid debates because they see nothing to gain. They've already shown, because they're an incumbent, they've shown that they can win in the district, and they're just hoping to consolidate their support. So for most incumbents, a debate is really just an opportunity to your challenger to gain name recognition, kind of gain credibility because they're up on stage with a sitting member of Congress, and it always provides the opportunity for a gaffe on their part, and no incumbent wants to risk that.
Mm-hmm. Dave, what do you see as the issues that 4th District constituents are most interested in?
Well, that's kind of tough to figure out. I think the 4th District is concerned about immigration, agriculture, of course. They tend to just be reliably Republican and conservative, and I think issues have not really dominated the conversation up in the 4th for a while. The district seems to have been very comfortable allowing Steve King to represent them however he feels fit, and I really don't think that issues are dominating this campaign either.
Valerie, we heard in our newscast at the bottom of the hour, Steve King commenting on the Kavanaugh situation, you know, taking the line that you're, you know, these are, have not been corroborated, these allegations toward him. Is that going to move the ball at all in the 4th District regarding voting, do you think?
I don't. I do agree with what Dave said previously. When it comes to the role of the prioritization of issues in voting in the 4th District, they aren't the number one thing because of the comfort that we've had. It's a very strong Republican district. When we've got 40% of registered voters identifying as Republicans and 25% of registered voters identifying as Democrats, it does come more to that partisan identity. When we think about the potential implications of what those comments that Representative King shared, I would say that they present talking points when it comes to people's perceptions and interpretations of what is happening. Mm-hmm. My hope is that it would contribute to a larger conversation and dialogue of what the Kavanaugh hearing itself has brought before us as a country. When we think about the role of accusations, we've also got the comments being made by not only President Trump, but other elected officials thinking about how, given the potential power of accusations, that this is a scary time for young men, how does that then correspond to sexual assault and reports of? I'm hopeful that when it comes to, as our elected officials are talking about this, including Representative King, that constituents within the 4th District will continue to think about and talk about it. Mm. But again, I don't think it's going to have an effect on the ultimate outcome of the 4th District race.
Put simply, Dave, disagree if you think this is too simplified, but the line the Republicans seem to be taking in a variety of comments is perhaps that the Me Too movement has gone too far. Does that resonate in the 4th District, perhaps, that this pendulum has gone too far?
I think that is probably accurate. It seems to be kind of the Republican line right now that the Me Too movement, simply by its existence, was going too far, that it was an issue that should not have been raised and discussed. And I think across the country there are a lot of people who disagree with that sentiment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Supposedly the year of the woman, Valerie, in this midterm election, in the midst of this Me Too movement, the impact you see on the 4th District, anything?
Well, I would say when it comes to potential impact, if not necessarily the U.S. race or U.S. House race, I do think that we are seeing across the state of Iowa an influx of women getting involved in politics, and that is absolutely the case for political participation beyond just registering to vote as well as putting your name on the ballot. We are seeing women becoming more engaged in the political process. So I think there are those sorts of ripple effects that we are seeing not only across the United States, but here in the 4th District.
Mm-hmm. Dave, give us a little bit of the evolution of this district, because we had redistricting in 2010. It reduced Iowa after the population census from 5 to 4 districts. Steve King used to be, well, he was first elected to the 5th district in northwest Iowa, and then it was redistricted, and Ames, where you are, was added to King's district in 2010. The thought then, making this more competitive, Ames would be a liberal hotbed, right?
I think by keeping Ames in the fourth, what you actually do is you make the other three districts more competitive. If Ames goes into any of those districts, they become much more Democratic and become likely to be Democratic congressional seats. So you can safely take a Democratic district like Ames and put it in a reliably Republican district like the fourth, and you just dilute those voters. They turn out to be wasted Democratic votes most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the other candidates here, not just the major party candidates. The Libertarian Party actually has major party status in Iowa. Valerie, can you tell us about Charles Aldrich, the Libertarian candidate for this congressional seat? Who is he?
Well, absolutely. Well, Charles Aldrich, he is from Clarion, and he is an industrial engineer. This is not the first time that we've actually seen him on the ballot. He did run as the Libertarian candidate for U.S. Senate in 2016. That was the race between Republican Senator Grassley as well as Democratic challenger Patty Judge. What we also know about Mr. Aldrich is that he does have a military background. He has served in the Marines, and he has been active in Libertarian Party politics in the state of Iowa. Now, what makes this an interesting aspect is that recently the Libertarian Party has been officially recognized as a party in the state of Iowa, and that's because it was due to the presidential party candidate, as you may recall, Gary Johnson, mm-hmm. in 2016, receiving surpassing that 2% threshold that is required by the state of Iowa in order to be recognized as a political party. So currently, that was declared in March of 2017 by our Secretary of State that the Libertarian Party is, in fact, a political party, just like the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And that hasn't happened for a while in the state of Iowa. The last time we did have that occur was way back in 2000 with the Green Party, when we had Ralph Nader receiving more than that 2% threshold of votes. So the fact that the Libertarian Party has received this status, I think, is also infusing some energy into their efforts.
Dave Anderson, I'm going to wager that if you went out on the street where you are, or if I went where I am, or Valerie where she is, and you just said, what does a Libertarian stand for? You would get a lot of questioning looks from people and non-answers. When we look at, we tend to say we have a political spectrum, right? Or right to left, or whatever. So where are the Libertarians? What is going on with the party in terms of what they stand for?
So a lot of times when people talk about liberals and conservatives, liberals are considered to be people who believe that the government should regulate the economy so you can tax and spend, but really should not interfere with people's personal decisions on how to live their lives. Whereas conservatives are the other way, and they would say, well, the government should not regulate the economy. We should keep taxes low and not spend anything on services. But they should play a role in regulating people's lives, telling people what is the proper way to live. But it doesn't have to be that way. Libertarians are kind of a combination of both, where they say the government should do nothing, should not regulate the economy, so keep taxes low and services low, but also should not regulate people's lives. So libertarians both tend to believe things like we should cut government regulations, we should cut spending, cut taxes, but we should also legalize drugs and legalize access to purchase things that the FDA says are not safe products, because government interference is always bad. It's mm-hmm. kind of a libertarian view.
And yet it seems libertarians side, even though you've got this hybrid that you described, they seem to side with Republicans. Take the case of Rand Paul. Calls himself a libertarian, right?
Sure. And I think right now Rand Paul is the most prominent libertarian. But I think it also cycles depending on who is in power, because libertarians almost always oppose whatever party is in power. So libertarians in the early 2000s, when George W. Bush and the Republican Party was in charge, tended to side with Democrats and liberal ideas a little bit more, because the talking points of that day were largely about civil rights and civil liberties, enhanced interrogation or torture, the right of the state to investigate people and wiretap and monitor electronic transmissions, and all of those things violated libertarian beliefs. So back in the early 2000s, a lot of libertarians kind of leaned more closely to the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. We have another candidate to talk about, Valerie. Please introduce us to Edward Peterson. This is an independent candidate, so this is not considered a major party candidate, but nevertheless on the ballot.
Mm-hmm. So when we think about Edward Peterson, again, he is an independent, and again, we don't have a great deal of information. Like, for example, when we typically, for those who are interested in learning about who to vote for, and they're trying to gain more information, so they may go look at maybe campaign finance and go to the FEC. We're not seeing this sort of information being provided. So when it comes to learning more about Edward Peterson, we know that he is indeed an independent who will be on the ballot. And what we know in terms of what he's done in the past is there isn't a whole lot of information to find.
Mm, okay. Dave, do you see any of these other candidates, Libertarian, Independent? I mean, sometimes they can get the numbers to be, I guess, spoilers. Do you see them affecting the fourth district race in this case?
Anything's possible. I could foresee a future where if Steve King continues to refuse to debate Shulton, Shulton could just say, you know, the Libertarian candidate's a major party candidate, and Libertarians may be on the gubernatorial debate stage, and why not have a debate between the Democrat and Libertarian? And if that happens, that may siphon some votes away from King to the Libertarian who's on the stage. And that could weaken King's margin enough to make this a really competitive race.
Mm-hmm. Just as a note to Iowa Public Radio listeners in terms of this political season, we on Iowa Public Radio will be featuring interviews with all of the candidates, including the Libertarian candidates, because they have major party status in Iowa in all of the congressional races and also in the gubernatorial race, just as a little footnote there. Before we go, I wanted to have, Dave, let me ask you about this, the trade deal. We want to focus perhaps on our News Buzz Friday on this, more of the economics of what this means for Iowa. But if you take a political slant on this, on Sunday, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico striking a new trade deal. This replaces NAFTA. It's known as the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, USMCA. I've heard you can sing that tune, YMCA, but you have to put USMCA if you want to, I guess, substitute this. A silly aside. All right. Three countries reaching a consensus after more than a year of talks, all beginning when Donald Trump made good on a campaign promise to renegotiate this nearly 25-year-old agreement, NAFTA 2.0. What I'm seeing here, Dave, comment on the politics of this, major changes, cars and new policies on labor, environmental standards, intellectual property protections, some digital trade provisions. Comment on what you see. I guess we're seeing this as a victory for Donald Trump.
I think it is a victory for Trump. I would argue that this is his first real victory of his presidency. The only other things that sometimes get thrown out as victories for him are appointing one and potentially two Supreme Court justices, which is kind of a gimme when your party controls the Senate.
There's the tax plan, too.
And the tax plan that he had no part of. The only role that President Trump played in the tax plan was in allowing Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell to determine what it was. And he interfered at the end by repeatedly tweeting that he may not sign the thing, but then eventually he backed down and agreed to. So I think that's a congressional victory. Mm-hmm. But this is clearly President Trump. He went out on a limb. He personally said that NAFTA was a terrible deal, the worst deal ever made, and then said that he was going to renegotiate it to be a massive win for America. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody in the country thought that was a crazy notion.
Right. And so does this justify the president's hardball approach to even our allies in playing hardball with our allies in terms of getting better trade conditions for the U.S.?
Potentially. I think a lot of people were surprised to see that we negotiated successfully, renegotiated the deal. And I feel like a lot of people right now are holding their breath to really look into the details of the deal and see how it is going to benefit different segments of America and likely to figure out who is going to be harmed in America from it, because most trade deals have benefits, but they also come with costs. And I think the benefits that we're seeing so far are access to the Canadian dairy industry, certainly automobile manufacturing, But we're not really sure yet of the economic impact of all these things. It may be meager, it may be large, and we're still waiting for some economists to really score this potential trade deal and figure out who's going to be the big winners, if there are going to be any big losers. And I think still a lot of people are waiting in their judgment of this. It seems like a big victory, but we're not sure yet.
Dave Anderson, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Thanks for coming in today, Dave.
My pleasure.
Valerie Hennings, Associate Professor of Political Science at Morningside College in Sioux City, the first time on our Politics Wednesday program. Valerie, thank you for your initial offerings. We sure appreciate them, and we'd love to have you back on again sometime.
Well, great. Thank you so much.
Reminder again, tomorrow on this program, political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben of NPR's Washington desk will be a guest of mine. We'll talk about, of course, gender politics, demographics, economic policy. Those are her focuses in politics, and we hope you'll join us. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Caitlin Harrop. Also, Alyssa Bavinet helped us out today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.